Jericho Road is a podcast and a Sunday school class and a ministry of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Birmingham, Alabama. These days, we're talking about the Ark and the Temple, meeting God in the past, present, and future. We hope you'll join us. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Jericho Road. And this fall, we've been looking at two concepts when it comes to our worship, the Ark and the Temple, two expressions of worship in the Hebrew Scriptures that have an effect on us today. And in past episodes, we've gone at great length to discuss the exile of 586 BC. This is when the Judean nation, right, the two tribes in the south with the capital city of Jerusalem, were defeated by the Babylonian army, their capital city destroyed along with their temple, and then their best and brightest taken to a far away city, thinking that they would never return home again. We got that story. But there was another. Now, some 136 years before, in 722 BC, another Mesopotamian superpower invaded the land of the Hebrews and wiped the northern kingdom of Israel off the map. It seems it was the policy of that particular empire to displace people and to mix them up into sort of a meso one world order. And I've also done some reading suspecting that they also would invade other countries when they lost their labor pool due to a pandemic. So we know that pandemics change things, right? Even to this day. In May 2022, a cave in southeast Turkey at a place called Basbuk confirmed something that the Mesopotamians would do with depictions of Assyrian deities with their gods. However, their gods had local Aramean features and local Aramean faces. So it also confirms the account of 2 Kings chapter 17, and I'll just read a few verses. 2 Kings 17, verse 24. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria in place of the people of Israel. They took possession of Samaria and settled in its cities. And when they first settled there, they did not worship the Lord because they did not know the Lord, and the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you've carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of this land. Therefore he sent lions among them. They are killing them because they do not know the law of the God of the land." Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there. Let him go and live there and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel, and he taught them how they should worship the Lord. Sargon II of Assyria would also record the capture of a very precise dude, Sargon, the capture of 27,290 deportees at the same time. And this is the origin of the Samaritan people, a mixed up bunch of folks where the kingdom of Israel used to be. So in this podcast, I want to revisit the Samaritans, which is something that we did last year, but now with an eye towards the temple, or rather how the lack of the temple in Jerusalem being available to them would shape a religion that continues even to this day. Yep, there are Samaritans today. There's some 800 plus or minus Samaritans, and most of them living in Mount Gerizim in the north in Samaria, although some live in a neighborhood outside of Tel Aviv. They call themselves Bene Israel, or the children of Israel, or the Shamarim, the observant ones. They only read a Samaritan tweaked version of the Pentateuch, which are the first five books of the Bible. And in the early 20th century, they dwindled down to about 200. So they allowed some limited outside marriages for the men that helped them to survive. And I got to tell you, intermarrying for that long can never be a very good thing. That's all I'll say about that. A Samaritan revolt of the 5th century against the Eastern Roman Empire is the most direct, really, reason for their decline. And so many were killed, and then a Byzantine church was erected on their holy site, and I'll say some more about that in a minute. The Samaritans are led by a high priest. This high priest is believed to be a descendant of Aaron, and when God's people, the Hebrews, returned from their exile, right, 70 years after that original exile in 586 BC, the Samaritans then showed up to help. They look like Hebrews. They've got a Aaronite priesthood, right? They worship like Hebrews. But as we learned in 2 Kings chapter 17, they were foreign people who were simply taught to worship like Hebrews, and they were received this way by Ezra. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah in our Hebrew scriptures are stories of this rebuilding time. Ezra is a priest and a scribe, and then Nehemiah is a government official. In Ezra chapter 4, we're told this: when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the families and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of King Esarhaddon of Assyria, who brought us here." Zerubbabel, Yeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel said to them, "You shall have no part in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as the king Cyrus of Persia has commanded us." This would set up 4 centuries of bad Samaritan-Hebrew relations. It really begins right away. We're told in the next book of Nehemiah, which is Nehemiah chapter 4. Now, when Sanballat heard — Sanballat is a Samaritan official — when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he mocked the Jews. He said in the presence of his associates and of his army in Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish it in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and the burned ones at that?" This taunting would lead to a ban on mixed marriages later in Nehemiah chapter 13. We'll learn that even the high priest kid gets run off from marrying a Samaritan girl. But why? I mean, all this sounds kind of xenophobic, right? It's not really attractive that Ezra and Nehemiah would rebuff their neighbor's help and not want any foreigners to marry into their families. Kind of sounds like the Samaritans themselves in 2023. But I think the concern here has less to do with demonizing other people than it does with personal holiness and ethics. If we read the Hebrew scriptures as a whole, we'll see they've got precedent here, and they're not afraid to tell a story on themselves. Solomon strayed when he married foreign women because he worshiped foreign gods, even as he was building the temple in Jerusalem. King Ahab in the north, the northern kingdom of Israel, was a fine king on paper. He was a good soldier and a great administrator, but he married a foreign princess, Jezebel, a Phoenician queen, and so he strayed by murdering a man and taking a piece of land. The Hebrews labored hard to stay apart in exile. Remember the Philistines in the Bible, the bad boys of the Bible? The Philistines are Goliath and Delilah and all the armies that gave them all that trouble. They disappeared in the exile, which is exactly what the Babylonians had intended, which is exactly what the Assyrians, who were the Mesopotamian power before, did to the kingdom of Israel. The whole point was to make you go away. But the Hebrews worked really, really hard to stay together. They stayed together and they stayed apart. And I think I know why. There is a danger in getting your story just a little wrong. In seminary, I learned that the definition of a heresy is a truth pushed too far. I'll give you some Christian examples. Early on, people began to think about Jesus and the stories, and they would say, well, if Jesus is God, then he must be Superman. He must be Superman dressed up like a human and the nails don't hurt. That's a heresy, right? God went the distance for us and the nails and did indeed hurt, and he did indeed die for us and rise for us to show us how it works. Or in the second century, a fellow named Marcion would conclude that the Old Testament God is a bad God, a God of fear and anger, and the New Testament God is a God of love and grace, and so the Old Testament God stories must be thrown away. That's another heresy. As you can tell, if you spend any time with me in this podcast, I spend as much time in the Old Testament as I do in the New. A modern one is to assume that Jesus started a new religion, distinct from Judaism, and of course that would lead to anti-Semitism and eventually would lead to the Holocaust of the last century. So, a heresy is a truth pushed too far, and I saw this firsthand when I met the brother of the high priest of the Samaritans a couple of summers ago. Sweet fellow. Mount Gerizim is a place where there's a pretty little Samaritan village. They make tahini up there. They make really good tahini up there. And I had a nice afternoon chat with the brother of the high priest, complete in Samaritan robes. He was kind of like a nutty uncle with a bunch of conspiracy theories. He had a sleeping teenage daughter, rather granddaughter, on the sofa, which felt right to me. I bore my children to death. He told me that Samaritan was the original language of Adam and Eve, which had me laughing in my sleeve a little bit. And he told me he knew where to find the bones of Joseph. But modern Samaritans are still important for us to study. They're very nice people and important for us to learn because they're like a time capsule. After their expulsion from Jerusalem, they would copy-paste the temple back on top of Mount Gerizim. They would go back and build a temple that is as close a resemblance and in construction to to Solomon's temple that we could possibly have, the one that had been destroyed and then rebuilt and then destroyed by the Romans later. It has an eastern altar. It has a Holy of Holies. It faces east. It has a western wall near the holy place. I mean, everything that they have. And it's on Mount Gerizim because of instructions from Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 11 as he was giving Joshua the instructions for the disbursement of the land. And he told them to go to Mount Gerizim and build an altar of blessing. And then to Mount Ebal, which is across the valley in Samaria, to build an altar of cursing. And I think what Moses is doing here is he's using mountains instead of pyramids to remind them, right? Something natural, something God made, and something human made to show them how to live. Well, the Samaritans would take Deuteronomy chapter 11 and just run with it. I mean, they just run with this idea that this was the holy mountain. And so today they still worship on the slopes. Now, I mentioned this before, it was defiled because the Eastern Romans put a church on top of their holy place. So they can't do their sacrifices up there anymore. It's a no-no. But on the slopes of the mountain, they still sacrifice a Passover lamb, still. So they're a time capsule doing Old Testament things with Old Testament priests. In the world of Jesus, pilgrims from Galilee would travel to Jerusalem for their worship in this way that we can still see today on Mount Gerizim. But they would travel to Jerusalem, and they had three ways to get there. If you were living, say, in Nazareth or Capernaum, you could travel the Via Maris, which is a Mediterranean highway road that exists today. They simply built a highway over the old Roman road, but that's out of the way. That's kind of going way around to get there. You could go to Jerusalem down the Jordan River Valley, which is what we believe Jesus did mostly, and mostly on the eastern shore of the Jordan River, but you never strayed far from the water because you're going down to the most dangerous part on planet Earth. I mean, it's the lowest part of that crack in the earth called the Great Rift Valley. So better stay near water. And then you've got to climb some 3,000 feet to get to Jerusalem out of that hole with the Jericho Road. And then you had a route that was pretty temperate and fairly easy to walk. It was straight down through Samaria, and you get Mediterranean breezes and water and green things, if you will. But you didn't go that way. They didn't walk that way because of harassment, quite frankly. Harassment, at best, you would be taunted for walking to Jerusalem when there's a perfectly fine temple on the top of Mount Gerizim. At worst, they might hurt you, which is fascinating to me because the first story that Jesus tells in Luke's gospel after deciding to go to Jerusalem to die is the story of the Good Samaritan. Now we begin to understand why Samaritans matter in their world, and why it was such a shock to call the Samaritan good. In John chapter 4, Jesus gives a Samaritan woman, quote, living water, unquote, which is a word used for temple worship during the festival of Sukkot in the shadow of Mount Gerizim, meaning that God was busting out everywhere, even up there at their little copy-paste temple on the hill. Still, there's more to this lesson than simply people becoming a time capsule or for us to go visit them on the Passover. Rather, the Samaritans become a case study in the danger of getting the story wrong. Because Ezra, the priest and scribe that we quoted in Ezra chapter 4, is largely credited with the canonization of the Hebrew Bible, it's no surprise that they would stick with the first five. Still, they doctored it. And it's dangerous to try to change God to fit our agendas or to change God's words to make it say something else. And in the Samaritan Bible, the Ten Commandments end not with thou shalt not covet, which is our last commandment, but rather the Ten Commandments and the Samaritan Ten Commandments end with thou shalt build a temple on Mount Gerizim. And here's where this is very, very wrong. In a past episode, I mentioned that writing is about 5,000 years old. It was a new technology at the time of the earliest stories of the Bible. It was originally invented to record grain for the king and then to proclaim the king divine and to keep everybody in line. And then, as we saw in the destruction of Israel, it was a time for Sargon to record all the deportees. So writing was important for those in power. And yet God took slaves out of Egypt, the story of the Exodus, and rescued them and took people who didn't have power and gave them writing too. And this is very important. He took them to a high mountain, and as we've mentioned, I think God likes mountains better than pyramids because that's God-made and not human-made. And there on the mountain took God's own finger and wrote the divine mind, 10 commandments or 10 precepts for us to live and to be happy, the first 4 in union with God and the last 6 in union with neighbor. That's it, guys. Just stay in your lane with these 10 ends, and we will live. And then in the fullness of time, when God would become one of his own creation, Jesus would begin his great inaugural address, the Sermon on the Mount, with 10 Beatitudes, which are simply words that mean ways to be happy, the first 4 in union with God and the last 6 in union with each other. It's like a cosmic do-over, because by the time you get to the world of Jesus, 10 commandments had become 613, and we know that you can find a loophole not to love someone. It's only been about 10. However, there's nothing in the union with neighbor part that involves a house, ever. Remember this first podcast episode from this season, 2 Samuel chapter 7. God is clear. He doesn't want a house. God was worried that a house would be a confusion between means and ends, or a distraction, or a checkbox to get them thinking that they were doing something when they were really only traveling to the house. Solomon would build it anyway, and in 1 Kings chapter 6, we're told that the house would become an elaborate building out of Solomon's own mind, and which would lead to the copy-paste version on Mount Gerizim today. But God said, I'll only live in this house if you follow me, if you follow me, and if you behave. And that's a mighty big if. I want to go back to the tablets of the Ten Commandments. The last 6 don't involve the building of a house. The last commandment is not build a house on Gerizim, not build a house anywhere. God doesn't want a house, because these tablets, these ends, these 10 ways to live, these are written on our heart. We are God's temple. And that's how they got it wrong. Thanks, everybody. Catch you next time. I like to say that everyone needs a good church in their life, and this is a great church. Locals will say that St. Luke's was born in 1949, but we're really much newer than that. Gosh, the last few years have taught us how to pivot, how to use food in creative ways, times of services, classes, outreach opportunities, many, many ways to get plugged in, to the point that I like to say that 3-year-olds love St. Luke's and 93-year-olds love St. Luke's, and everybody's got a place in between. This place is a conduit for a relationship with Jesus Christ and a lot of really nice people to join you in the journey along the way, and we would be honored if you join us too.